welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM, our home, 93.2, every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, just back from the heart of darkness, that's Aleppo, Syria. British journalist you won't see on Sky, the BBC or Channel 4 News. She's Vanessa Beely. Also, Marielle Finisterre, jazz singer, the best of Bath buskers. A real treat today. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Or Volunteering Bristol. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national do-it.org website. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Vanessa Beely. She's a British journalist that spent several months over in Aleppo, really pulling apart what's behind the conflict in Syria. Of course, the old colonial power, up until just after the Second World War, were the French, and they play a big role in the conflict still. Terrorism is at the heart of it. And the big question is, are these terrorists naturally occurring in Syria? Are these people just Syrian rebels? Or are they a battalion that's been assembled by the NATO countries, France, Britain and the United States?
France, again, can hardly be considered an impartial player in the neo-colonialist game. In July 2015, a group of Syrian plaintiffs from inside Syria took the country's foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, to court for what they described as stoking the conflict. They had lost relatives in the conflict to the various terrorist factions. And in 2012, many of you may remember that Laurent Fabius, who was then foreign minister, gave an interview to Le Monde's paper in which he described what Al-Qaeda were doing in Syria as a good job. Very recently, Manuel Valls, French Prime Minister, showing here his very clear allegiance to Israel. The majority of the French government is extraordinarily allied with Israel. Just to give you an example, in 2014, when Gaza was being bombed mercilessly by Israel, I went to a meeting in Paris where I discovered that there is actually a tax break, an official government tax break, for businesses inside France if they contribute to the Israeli offence forces. There's an actual, if you go onto the government website, you receive a percentage reduction in your tax if you contribute to the Israeli army. In a recent speech at the Assemblée Nationale, Manuel Valls told members of the White Helmets that Aleppo is their battle, probably harking back to the time when Syria was a French colony, which ended in 1946, but maybe somebody should remind him. Honoured guests in France during that time were, as he's now called, President Raed Salah of the White Helmets, and a guy called Britta Haji Hassan, with whom I've been having a very interesting conversation over the last few days. Raed Salah, some of you may recognise as he calls himself now, the President of the White Helmets, the leader of the White Helmets, who, by the way, was extradited from the United States in April 2016. He was kicked out of Dulles Airport for his extremist connections. It was finally admitted by the US State Department. However, his extremist connections somehow didn't reflect upon the organization itself. I'm not quite sure how that one works when they bombed Iraq for their connections to Al-Qaeda, but hey, it's the United States. Britta Haji Hassan has called himself the mayor of Aleppo. However, my sources tell me that he's a member of Ar-Rashan, as I said, one of the most brutal ethnic cleansing organizations inside Syria right now, still not designated a terrorist organization by the United States, who are desperately trying to keep the moderate level label stuck on some militant faction somewhere. Both of these guys were entertained as heroes in France, much to the disgust of many French, as the White Helmets have been proven to have connections to the very terrorist organisations that carried out the attacks in Bataclan, in Nice, and in Paris at Charlie Hebdo. So kind of an extraordinary turn of events. In fact, Maria Zakharova, who I had the privilege to meet with in Moscow about 10 days ago, she made the very clear point that these so-called local councils, the majority of whom have received their funding and training inside Gaziantep, as I mentioned, Gaziantep inside Turkey is the hub where they build these shadow state organizations to then send them into Syria to supplant the existing Syrian state institutions. This is a very common NATO intervention ploy. They carried this out in Iraq. They've done it pretty much globally. And she basically made the point that the illegal armed units have given complete control over life-sustaining issues in eastern Aleppo, such as electricity supplies, school education, and bakeries. They've turned it into work for the council, so the councils that are then run by terrorist leaders. And they then use this humanitarian instrument as a tool to keep the local population under control. Now, I've seen this personally in 2012 in Egypt, when the Muslim Brotherhood did exactly this exercise leading up to the referendum at the end of 2012, which was instigated by Morsi to give him greater powers inside Egypt. I actually saw this. I was actually in Cairo during the referendum, and I could see that people were being forced to vote for the new constitution on the basis that the Muslim Brotherhood controlled all of the services in the various villages that they were coming from. So they controlled electricity, they controlled water, they controlled all of the hospital services, they controlled all of the education. So they had control over that population. Moving on to my favourite NGO in Syria, the White Helmets. You will all be aware that they recently failed to get the Nobel Peace Prize, something that I'm particularly proud of. We worked very hard leading up to that announcement. I worked with Nobel's Will, which is an organisation in Norway and Sweden, which acts as a watchdog of the Nobel Prize award. And through them, I managed to get all of my evidence to the Nobel Prize Committee. Now, I can't take the credit for it, but I was told that in the closed chamber, people that were coming out were saying that there was a very last-minute change of direction, which is extraordinary when you look at the celebrity government media backing that was behind the White Helmets' bid for that prize. Just to give you a very brief recap, is anybody unaware of who the White Helmets are? Okay. The White Helmets are basically a supposed first responder humanitarian NGO inside Syria, operating inside Syria. They were set up in 2013 by this guy in the middle, James Lemessurier, who's a British ex-military. He's been involved in pretty much every intervention from Kosovo across to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Palestine, to Yemen. He set up the White Helmets in 2013. He then also set up the Mayday Rescue in 2014. Mayday Rescue is now an official foundation, and it's through the Mayday Rescue that the majority of NATO state countries fund the White Helmets, and I'm talking up to 150 million in funding. So this is hardly a non-governmental organization operating inside Syria. It's received around $23 million from USAID, so the United States Department. It's received now, we think, around £65 million from the UK Foreign Office. Boris Johnson announced a few weeks ago that he would be giving them a further $32 million on top of the $19 million that was already given to them. And then various other countries have contributed. France, Germany, Denmark, Holland, Japan, and now publicly Qatar, who is probably one of the biggest financiers and controllers of the terrorist factions inside Syria, has publicly announced that they are funding the White Helmets. So, I mean, very clearly, even if we don't go any further, this is not an independent, impartial NGO. It cannot call itself that when its entire funding operation is coming from regimes who have stated and declared an interest in regime change in Syria. But then if we go back to James Lemessurier's background, if we go to the Olive Group, which he was working in a few years prior to setting up the White Helmets, that merged with the Constellis Group in May 2015, and under the Constellis umbrella is the Blackwater Group, or as it's now called, Academy. So this gives an idea of the circles that James Lemessurier moves in, which are the very high-profile private security firms that are fundamentally nothing more than an outreach assassination program for the CIA. And I'm not being sensationalist. That, again, has been very clearly documented and extensively reported. It was set up under President Bush. President Obama then put $250 million into the Blackwater coffers before they were then renamed as Academy to, again, try and distance them from the crimes that they had been committing in various Middle Eastern countries in particular, particularly in Iraq. So again, I am not being sensationalist here. These guys are outreach and outsource agents for the various deep state and intelligence agencies for our governments. And then the connections to Good Harbor. Good Harbor International is another organization based in Dubai, run by CEO Richard A. Clarke, who was Bush's terror advisor, has close ties to Rita Katz, an Israeli-American who set up SITE. SITE Intelligence is the organization that basically diffuses all of the ISIS execution videos. And one has to ask how they get access to these videos before anybody else. So that just gives you an idea on the background of the White Helmets, on their funding, and on who created them, who trained them, and who released them back into Syria. And then if we look at where the White Helmets operate, they only operate in terrorist-held areas. And when I say terrorist, Nusra-held areas or ISIS-held areas. There is extensive video evidence and document evidence. We've spent the last 3 months going through individual social media accounts and highlighting and picking out all of the photographs which shows their allegiance to either al-Sham, to Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda, or to ISIS. And it's very clear, it's on every single of an individual White Helmet account. None of them are hiding it. And to give you an example, this is Abdul Halim al-Shahab. He's a White Helmet based in Idlib. When we started to go through his page, we discovered all sorts of posts, obviously in Arabic, so it takes some time for us to go through and to find people to be able to translate it for us. But, for instance, on the right-hand side, you'll see the body of a Russian pilot being dragged. This body was later dismembered by the Nusra Front in Idlib. This pilot and his crew had been shot down a few days before we went into Aleppo. They had been dropping humanitarian supplies into East Aleppo. They'd flown from the base in Latakia to East Aleppo. They dropped food and humanitarian supplies to the civilians and to the militants. They differentiate. And then they were on their way back. They were shot down by a ground-to-air missiles, so these lightly armed moderate rebels shot down a Russian humanitarian helicopter. Thankfully, as we were told by some of the Russians that we met in Aleppo, the crew died almost instantly, including one woman. But their bodies were, as far as I know, dismembered, as are all the bodies of those lost in battle against these terrorist factions. And again, this was something that I was told by many people, that the great fear is if they lose a member of their family in one of these battles or in one of these clashes, Their greatest fear is that they can't recover the body because the body will be dismembered, it'll be desecrated, it'll be mutilated. It certainly will not be given the dignity of a burial, as is described by white helmets in their promotional material. So if we look at all of these white helmet pages, they were all basically celebrating the death of this Russian pilot that had just dropped humanitarian aid to their own colleagues in East Aleppo, and enjoying the fact that his body was being humiliated and desecrated like this. But then it gets even more interesting. On this same white helmet page, he had a meme up, which basically, when you translate the Arabic, it translates as exterminate Kafraya. Now, Fura and Kafraya are two Idlib villages, so they're right in the middle of the Idlib countryside. I hate using sectarian language, but I will use it only to demonstrate the white helmets' lack of impartiality and their sectarian agenda inside Syria. Kafra and Fura are Shia villages, Shia Muslim villages. They have been under partial siege since 2011 and full siege since March 2015. They've lost now probably nearly 2,000 civilians that have been shelled, sniped, just basically that the terrorists tunneled underneath. The terrorists have tunneled underneath the houses and detonated underneath the houses. The residents are sniped inside their own kitchens. We met people in Damascus who had managed to get out of Kafraya and Fura despite the siege. One woman had been sniped in her own kitchen. She'd been shot through the head. The bullet had passed through her face and out the other side, and she was still completely paralyzed down her left side. Fairly recently, a young child, 7 years old, was sniped in the stomach. Again, these children, these civilians, are never mentioned in Western media. And the white helmets, all over their pages, are calling for the extermination. So they're calling for a sectarian ethnic cleansing in Idlib, hardly the actions of a humanitarian NGO. And this is not isolated. I've just taken one example from one page. But every one of their pages has examples similar to this or even more extremist. They were awarded the Atlantic Council Freedom Awards this year, but a look at previous winners gives an indication as to why they received it. So John McCain and Hillary Clinton, probably two of the biggest war hawks inside the United States. Then we had the Netflix White Helmets film documentary, which was filmed entirely or made entirely in Turkey based on footage provided by the White Helmets. So the actual documentary makers never set foot inside Syria. The footage was supplied to them. It was not verified. It wasn't checked. It wasn't made sure that it was credible. It was just accepted, edited, and produced as a documentary. They have admitted this themselves in various interviews. Then let's have a look at who was behind the documentary. The Syria campaign was set up at the beginning of the war against Syria, and basically it runs the promotional activity for the White Helmets. And earlier this year, we picked up on a job advertisement from the Syria campaign in which they mentioned that we have big things coming up this year, including several high-profile campaigns and a film with an Oscar-nominated crew and global distribution partner. Join us and help make them happen. So in other words, even before the Netflix documentary was made, and by the way, it is among the five nominees for, guess what, the Oscar this year. I'm just trying to show you that this is, it's a very high-powered, slick marketing campaign that is behind the White Helmets. This is not some grassroots organization that has no support. It is multi-million funded by NATO state members and by Gulf state members now. It has an entire PR and marketing machine running behind it, probably even Hollywood-based. And so therefore, it's kind of extraordinary to me that it has maintained its credibility as long as it has. They also won the Right Livelihood Award, which is sort of the alternative Nobel Peace Prize. That will actually, the ceremony is going to be either the end of November or beginning of December. I can't remember the date right now. But we have a campaign running on this as well, with the Nobel Peace Prize watchdog, to try and pressure the RLA to actually retract this prize. So if anybody is convinced by this talk, if anybody wants to talk to me about it afterwards, those who are protesting the White Helmets receiving this prize are writing in to the website for the Right Livelihood, which is info@rightlivelihood.org. I mentioned the fact that the Nobel Peace Prize was actually derailed, but extraordinarily, almost as if they were prepared for this to happen, the next day, if not the same evening, guess what? This simple bakers, butchers, carpenters, candlestick makers organization suddenly had a fundraiser going to let's sort of compensate the White Helmets for not having won, not the Nobel Peace Prize, but the $1 million that came with the Nobel Peace Prize. Now we come to the interesting bit, for me anyway. One of the main reasons that I wanted to go to Syria was to meet with the real Syria Civil Defence. Not the White Helmets, as they call themselves, the Syria Civil Defence. They are not the Syria Civil Defence. The real Syria Civil Defence has been in existence since 1953. So for six decades, the White Helmets were set up in Turkey, not in Syria, in 2013, and it is funded not by Syria, it's funded by nations who want regime change in Syria. Very important fact here. What we are seeing here is primarily British-funded shadow state building, the undermining of the existing Syrian state institutions and the supplanting of them with NATO constructs, with, in this case, primarily British-funded constructs, the White Helmets. For example, when you need the fire engine or when you need first responders in Syria, you call 113, exactly the same as, I hope it's still 999 in Britain. I haven't lived here for a while. There is no number for the White Helmets. There's nobody you can actually call. So that begs the question, well, what do people do who are in trouble? How do they get in touch with the White Helmets? Or are they working purely as triage and support for the terrorist organizations with whom they're embedded? So the real Syria Civil Defense, who work in both terrorist and government-held areas, by the way, many of them have lost their lives going into terrorist-held areas to rescue civilians from under mortar fire or under guided missile attacks. The terrorist factions, by the way, to the north of Aleppo, particularly the ones in Idlib, to the north of Aleppo. There are three particular brigades, 13th Division, the Mountain Hawks, and I can never remember the third one, are heavily funded by the CIA, trained by the CIA, and armed by the CIA. And they now have Grad missiles, which have come in from Bulgaria and Tunisia, among other countries. And these Grad missiles are now being used also against the northern areas of the city itself and the surrounding countryside. And these missiles are used against these first responders. When they go into terrorist-held areas, what is happening is that the militant factions are picking them off. For instance, we have here the remains of a fire truck that went to a call-out in Homs. This is actually from the real Syria Civil Defense headquarters in Damascus. They went to respond to a call from Homs to a civilian area that was under attack from the terrorist factions. As they drove into the mortar-hit area, They were actually hit by a guided missile, and all three crew members were wiped out instantly. This is, again, to me, this is part of the criminal activity by our government to destroy the Syrian institutions, the Syrian humanitarian institutions, the Syrian state institutions that are so cohesive inside Syria. It's an extraordinary thing to witness. The Syrian state's efforts to keep supplying its civilians, to maintain its infrastructure, despite, one, crippling economic sanctions that affect the real Syria civil defence, but do not affect the White Helmets. The White Helmets have no issue getting equipment into Idlib, by the way, from Turkey, from EU through Turkey and into Idlib. And then it's distributed to the White Helmet centres across the terrorist-held areas. They are not affected by the sanctions. These guys are. The real Syrian civil defence, if they run out of something, they don't get any replacement. For instance, the real Syrian civil defence in West Aleppo are dealing with chemical attacks almost on a weekly basis from the terrorists in East Aleppo. The reasons they lost one of their crew members, Mohammed Ibish, age 36, on the 2nd of August. Why? Because they have no gas masks. They haven't been able to replace them. So all they have are the paper masks, which are no defence against mustard gas, chlorine, any sort of chemical weapons that are being used against them in West Aleppo. And so, you know, this is a common occurrence, is that the Syrian state institutions are battling the crippling economic sanctions, the intervention from NATO, which includes the invasion by proxy forces, and, of course, hostile propaganda, hostile diplomacy. This is Engineer Saad. He is based in the Damascus headquarters of the Real Syria Civil Defence, which, as we drove up to it, you have Jaish al-Islam directly and in front of you, about 50 metres away, and to the left you have Jobar, which is a very well-known terrorist-held area. So this entire centre is under attack on a regular basis. Every time they go out to respond to a call, they are driving through terrorist-held areas. This guy was hit. You can see his left hand is slightly, it's hanging. It's paralysed. He was hit in one of the attacks on the centre. He was operated on for about 8 hours, and he still has no movement in that hand. This ambulance, for example, was stripped clean by the terrorists, and they've been unable to replace any of the equipment in it, any of the life-saving equipment in it. So it's useless as an ambulance. When I was in West Aleppo and I was speaking with the Real Syria Civil Defence there, what they also told me, there were members of the crew there who came from East Aleppo to West Aleppo, and they told me that when the terrorists came in 2012, they massacred crew members, they kidnapped others. One of those crew members that I spoke to had been told if he stayed, he had to work with the terrorists. He refused, he fled. They burnt down his house, they put his name on all of the checkpoints so that if he were to come back, he would be assassinated. And his family, who had to be left behind in East Aleppo, are under constant risk of execution. What he also told me was that those terrorists that came in 2012 then were transformed into the White Helmets. But he categorically said to me, they are not humanitarian workers, they are terrorists, they are armed, and they are working alongside the terrorists. Another very clear example, Real Syria Civil Defence is a member of the International Civil Defence Organisation. Just prior to the Nobel Peace Prize announcement, the link to the Syrian Arab Republic, Syrian Civil Defence, was broken and reconnected to the White Helmets by surprise. So luckily we noticed it and we phoned them. And this was a conversation that I actually had with the ICDO. We ran through basically what had happened. He said it was an administrative mistake, fair enough. But the interesting fact that came out of it was that they do not recognise, and neither does the UN, they do not recognise the White Helmet as a first responder civil defence organisation. Very important fact. as I mentioned, when you go to the White Helmet funding page, you'll see a very clear meme which shows all of the equipment and how you should be funding it. Well, that's very interesting if they were to be affected by the economic sanctions that is affecting every single other Syrian institution. However, as I mentioned to you, the White Helmets seem to be immune to sanctions. Then let's have a quick look at another media organisation, Channel 4. A very recent video that they put out and then very quickly took down. I don't know if anybody actually noticed this, but this is indicative of Channel 4's reporting on the crisis in Syria. They've run with a very NATO-aligned narrative. They've become very bullish. In fact, I mentioned today, they've become the Fox News of UK media to a huge extent. They bully their interviewees. They maintain their propaganda line even when faced with evidence to the contrary. And in this particular video...
It's early morning and they're planning an attack. Their way of defending East Aleppo is to hit back by sending suicide bombers to the Syrian army. And by launching rockets into the west side of the city.
They just normalise suicide bombers and attacks on civilians in West Aleppo. That was just completely nonchalantly put into the report as if it's perfectly normal that suicide bombers should be used as a legitimate weapon against the indigenous national army, or that it's normal that they defend themselves by attacking civilians in West Aleppo. But that's not the worst part of this video. The actual stars of this video were the beheaders of 12-year-old Abdullah Issa. So Channel 4 is telling you that child beheaders and executors and torturers are rebels and deserve to defend themselves against the civilians of West Aleppo by mortaring them, by sniping them, by explosive bullets. Extraordinary, I find that extraordinary. Here's another identification. So these are the actual beheaders. They're not even just associated with Nur al-Din Zinki. They are the actual executors of that child. Now, when this was pointed out to Channel 4, and when in fact Channel 4 was attacked for this video, they immediately took it down. Unfortunately, many of us took a copy of it. And then in among these nice beheading operatives that they called rebels, we find, guess what? The White Helmets. Again, this is completely ignored by Channel 4. It's not even picked up on that somebody that has just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize is running alongside child beheaders in East Aleppo carrying weapons. Great media we have. And then let's look at another. Dr. Hamza Khatib, one of the last doctors in Aleppo before a few more came in. The BBC Channel 4 CNN poster boy. Now, here we have a photograph of Dr. Hamza al-Khatib alongside Fast Akim. Now, you might ask, who are Fast Akim? They're a new one. But you're right. This is kind of the gangs and counter-gang warfare that is going on inside Syria. Fast Akim are a splinter from Nur al-Din Zinki, the child beheaders. Fast Akim set up to distance themselves from Nur al-Din Zinki, but they have the same ideology, the same extremism, the same methods of killing civilians as Nur al-Din Zinki. They are basically Nur al-Din Zinki rebranded. But here we have Channel 4's mainstay witness from East Aleppo discussing tactics with a terrorist organisation. Oddly enough, Channel 4, despite various emails and tweets from me, have not yet responded. Then we have CNN, Christiane Amanpour. Here, she's interviewing Mulham al-Qaidi. He's the leader of Fast Akim, ex-Nur al-Din Zinki. So actually, predominantly these days, we are getting the majority of our mainstream media narrative from terrorists. There's no other way around it. There was in Holland, there was a news report from East Aleppo from a guy that's on Britain's Al-Qaeda watch list.
That was British journalist Vanessa Bealey speaking in Frome last week. That's at the Frome Stop the War group, and you can follow what they do on Facebook or online. Just look up on your favourite search engine, Stop the War Frome. Fascinating lot of talks, and also many talks, similar talks, taking place at the Ark Bar here in Bristol. That's on Broad Street on the left-hand side near the bottom.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now, one of the best of Bath's buskers, a real treat for you, Marielle Finisterre, jazz singer. And it's Dave Bazanko that introduces her.
Bit of a music feature this week. We've got a guest who's come in all the way from sunny Bath, where she busks with backing tracks. And your name is Marielle Finisterre.
Yes, Marielle Finisterre. Yeah.
Okay. Pardon my pronunciation.
No, don't worry.
Okay. How did you get into busking?
Actually, well, it's a bit strange because I used to do a bit of busking when I was very little with my parents. They both were into theatre. And so I passed the hat.
Okay.
I was part of the act in that sense. But it was great fun and I really enjoyed it. And then they stopped doing it for many, many years. And then I met someone, actually my boyfriend, in Mexico many years ago. And he brought me to England. So that's how I ended up in Bath, following my heart's desire.
Okay.
And he proposed that we did busking. And at first, it was a bit of an odd idea because by that time, I was more used to singing in pubs. But then it was like, okay, let's do it. And that's how it started. And then it became like the regular thing to do. And it's really cool. I mean, I have so much fun doing it. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, you've picked out a few tracks that we'll play now. The first one, would you like to introduce it? What's it called?
It's called A Tisk and a Tasket. It's a song that was made popular by Ella Fitzgerald. It's one of her very early recordings, I think. It's from around 1939 or something. Like, it's really old. And I picked that one because it's one of my favorite ones. Probably it's not the one that I would say that shows off my voice the most. But I have a real blast singing it because the lyrics are so quirky.
Excellent. Well, we'll listen to that now.
Yes, on the way I dropped it, a little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket. She was struggling on down the avenue, not a single thing to do. She went and peck, peck, pecking all around. When she spied it on the ground, she took it, she took it. I wish that little girl I could see.
So do we, so do we, so do we, so do we.
basket and make me happy again and again.
Was it green?
No, 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 no.
Was it red?
No, 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 no.
Was it blue?
No, 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 no. Just a little yellow basket.
Okay, that was A Tisk and a Tasket. The next one is Too Darn Hot. Why did you choose this one?
Again, it's a fun tune. Actually, the present show I do in the streets is pretty much like really old jazz. And I pick those songs because they make me happy and it helps people be happy too. And that's like my main purpose when I'm out there, is to make people feel good. Before I used to do a different show with my boyfriend, which was more folky, but all our songs were so sad. You know, everybody died in those songs. So now I like to keep it lighter. And this song, one of my favorite things about this song, it's another Ella Fitzgerald tune. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of hers, is that it has a lot of these words that were part of, like, the slang of the time, you know, like coo and woo and, you know, it's funny language and I like it. So, yeah.
Too Darn Hot.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. Brother, you'll find my baby tonight. 'Cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight. And teach the woo with my baby tonight. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight. Pitch the woo with my baby tonight. But I am up to my baby tonight. 'Cause it's too darn hot. According to the Kinsley Report, every average man, you know, much prefer his lovey-dovey to court when the temperature is low. But when the thermometer goes way up and the weather is sizzling hot, Mr. Pants, romance it's not. 'Cause it's too, too, too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
after that, you've got an Edith Piaf song for us. Je ne regrette rien?
Yes.
Ah, brilliant. Why did you choose this one?
Well, I chose this one because it's the one I used to close my show. I've always been a huge fan of Piaf. Also, the first time one of my aunties, she lived in her youth in Paris, and she was a huge fan of hers, and that's how I picked it up, through her. And, well, she was also a busker, in a way, so that's how she started. And I think her voice is so touching and moving. And this song, I think it's just grand. You know, it has so much power, and also the lyrics are like, I have no regrets, and it doesn't matter if they have hurt me in the past or the good that I've received from others, and like all the memories I have, like, I don't regret anything because today my life begins with you. So it's a love song, but it's so like triumphant, you know, it's epic. So yeah, that's why I picked it up.
Ni les biens qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. C'est payé. Souvenirs, je allume le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin de balayer les amours avec leur tremblement, balayer pour toujours. Je réparerai. Ni les biens qu'on m'a fait, ni les mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. Car ma vie, car mes jours,
well, thank you for that music. It's been brilliant listening to your singing. Do you have anything online that we can look up?
Not so much music yet. I will be soon recording new material. I do have a CD that includes A Tisk and a Tasket, but also has Cheek to Cheek and La Vie en Rose, another Piaf song, and several different tunes. But you can go to MARYELL.jazz, like music, in Facebook.
Okay.
And you can also check out Byron Calloway's YouTube channel. He's been filming a lot of buskers. Actually, that's how I ended up in this show. So you can see me singing live in the streets of Bath, mostly. So yeah, just pop in, give us a like, say hi, drop us a line. I'm also available for weddings and parties and pubs or anything. So yeah.
Thank you for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you so much, David.
What a treat. Non, je ne regrette rien. And the artist there is the Bath busker. And you can see her quite often in Bath, actually. Marielle Finisterre. She's got an album out called That Good Old Jazz, a CD, which has got several tracks: Cheek to Cheek, A Tisket, Stairway to the Stars, La Vie en Rose, Love Me Tender, Amazing Grace, I Just Want to Make Love to You, Big Spender, and I Feel Good, I Got You. You can find her on facebook.com/Marielle.jazz. That's Mary ELL dot jazz. And that is a Marielle Finisterre production. The interviewer was Dave Bazanko. That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download that podcast, carry it around with you, from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Vanessa Bealey, just back from Aleppo in Syria, the British journalist, and also, of course, Marielle Finisterre, the jazz singer from Bath. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. Anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897, or prsc.org.uk online. Also, there's the Volunteering Bristol website, one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Their phone numbers, 0117 989 7733. There's also a national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
feel.